tonight on Arena. Oscar winner Tilda Swinton on her new film, The End. And Thaivsha and Holland are among our films for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Film director Joshua Oppenheimer was on Arena back in November to talk about his film The End. It's a story about a billionaire family, father, mother, son, friend and butler. But they are no ordinary family. They are survivalists who have outrun the devastating end of the world, which has gone up in flames. They now live in an opulent end of times refuge in a repurposed salt mine. The father's business has in no small part added to the early destruction of the world, but he and his wife and son live out a fantasy life where they create their own stories about their life before arriving in this refuge. To show the delusion of the family, the director Oppenheimer has constructed the film as a musical, with the family members breaking into song to share their folly. Into this world comes a girl, a young woman who has sacrificed everything to escape the devastation. She finds safety in the bunker, but she cannot deal with the denial of the family. Michael Shannon plays father, George Mackay plays son, Moses Ingram girl, and Brona Gallagher plays friend. And mother is played by Oscar-winning actress Tilda Swinton. I spoke to Tilda earlier when I asked her what was her reaction on being asked by the director Joshua Oppenheimer to do a post-apocalyptic musical.
I was so honoured, Kay, because I was such an admirer of Joshua's anyway, his magisterial documentaries had really made an impact on me. And when I heard that he was making a feature film, a fiction, and that he might want to talk to me, I was really delighted. But then all he needed to say, I'm not even sure I read the script before I was hooked, because a musical about the end of the world by Joshua Oppenheimer kind of did it for me. I just could not stay away from it. And he sent photographs of the salt mines, and that was the icing on the cake, because it's such an exotic environment to go into.
Now, he said he had very much a love-hate relationship with musicals, how he adored them as a young boy, but then it just grated on him as he matured. What was your relationship with musicals?
I've always had a slightly sort of formal relationship with musicals. I know that I don't particularly worship at the church, but at the same time, I have, you know, there are great musical films that I really, really adore, like, you know, Singing in the Rain, or, for example, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The films where the singing feels completely woven into the narrative. The thing that I know he's talking about, I assume he's talking about when he says that to you, is, and what we really sort of drove into the curve of with this film, was the way in which these musical numbers are an expression of delusion, that these people sing to reinforce their deludedness and their fantasy. I mean, the film is a fairy story. It is a sort of fable. At the same time, there's something hideously documentary about it. I mean, it could easily be a documentary about, I'm sure that there are families right now under large swathes of Central European landmass that are in these, settling into these bunkers right now. And to that extent, I think it's probably fairly realistic. But at the same time, the sort of emotion of it is about fairy tale. All of these people in this story are telling each other fantasies and fictions and lies about their lives and about their pasts and about who they are.
So I think this young lady would like to know what we do around here, right?
I'm helping Dad write a book.
Oh.
He's my editor. I was in the energy business, and I guess I made a difference. So it's a way of giving something back. Hopefully somebody will read it. Did you show her the living room?
We walked through.
It's beautiful, isn't it? All the art she brought. You know, she chose each piece so carefully, from every movement and style. She's an artist too, a ballerina.
She danced at the Bolshoi.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Is there something wrong?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
That's okay.
Yeah.
All of them, there are only seven of them in this huis clos, this, you know, cage under the earth. And they're all just terrified little animals telling each other lies. And in a way, I think the songs just, they sort of punctuate and bump up these lies. They sing in order to reinforce the lies. That's how we approached it.
And the mother, your character, we are told she's a former ballet dancer with the Bolshoi Ballet. She adores art. She populates the living room with art from every era. Did you work with Joshua on what her cover story would be as the mother? This was the lore she brought to the family.
Yes, it was very interesting. The journey of finding her was very meticulous. I mean, I think pretty much all my comrades in the cast would say the same. In fact, all in the crew, because we were stepping into very fresh snow with this film. None of us really knew, and we still don't quite know what we were doing, and we still don't know what we've done, because everything felt so strange. You know, we weren't playing a rich family in a fabulous apartment in the upper east side of Manhattan, even though it looked like we were exactly that and we dressed like that. We weren't that. We were in this completely extraordinary, almost unimaginable situation of being in a bunker 25 miles under the earth. And yet we behave as if we're all just about to go and hail a cab and go to the Met. We all looked at our presuppositions about who these people might be, and we tried to steer away from cliche. It would be very easy for father to be someone really unsympathetic and bombastic and monstrous because he has done monstrous things. But one of the genius strokes of having Michael Shannon, and for Michael Shannon to play father the way that he does, is that he is, you know, we want to hang out with him. He is a very sympathetic person, even though in terms of his character, he has done and signifies monstrous things. Mother, I think in the very beginning, Joshua had an idea of her being incredibly controlling, rather passive-aggressive and cold. And it was very important to me that she wasn't any of those things, that she was actually, because apart from anything else, I feel I've seen that. I've seen the rich woman perfectly dressed, organizing, you know, the decor of every room and being very sort of micromanaging about what they eat. I've seen that in many, many films. It's a trope. And I felt that what we might be able to approach is the possibility of people feeling sympathy for these people. Because if, you know, we do ask an audience to sit for 2.5 hours in this very strange environment, really dystopian and unsettling. And if they don't know that they're with humans, then I think it would be very easy to leave. So we tried our best to be compassionate with these people and to look for their fragility, particularly with Mother, because she is the sort of architect of the whole narrative. And we needed her to be very vulnerable and actually unbalanced.
She is on a lot of medication, and the medication isn't working because she's still haunted by dreams.
There's a moment in the film where they're sort of on the verge of a fight. They're sort of in the middle of the beginning of a fight when Mother and Father says to her, we cannot be at war with each other. And it's such an interesting thing to hear, because it is absolutely true. And we realized when we were working that every single scene, even though there's tension running throughout the entire film, in every single scene there's some little microaggression, some little micro irritation. We cannot end the scene without coming back together again, because you can't. If you're, you know, if we were indeed in, you know, Upper East Side Manhattan, somebody could, you know, slam the door, go outside and go and walk in Central Park, or go and see a friend, or go and see a movie, or go and get drunk or something. But we can't, because we're stuck in this in this dungeon, effectively, this beautiful luxury dungeon. And so this feeling of them having to be on eggshells all the time with each other, that they cannot, and particularly with Mother, because she's clearly someone who is volatile and not mentally well, I would suggest. Everybody's just watching her for her responses to things. So it's high tension.
Yes, because when the girl comes, Tilda, and that really kind of throws things open, as it so often does in stories when a stranger comes in, she is troubled, the girl, about the sacrifice she has made to get to the bunker. But of course, that triggers Mother's own past and the terrible decisions she had to make, or choices she had to make, to get to the bunker with her husband.
The whole thing starts to unravel at that point when the girl comes in, because also the agreement that had been... Oh, it's all about agreements. You know, society is built on agreements, let's face it, and trust. We have to trust. And once we start to not trust, then the whole thing disintegrates. They'd struck this agreement, seemingly, Mother and Father, that nobody else would come in. This was the sort of bargain that Mother's made with herself, that it was the sacrifice, as you quite rightly put it, was worth it, because at least no one else is going to come in. It was all to save the son. It's all about saving my child and preserving the family. But then if that rule is going to be broken, if that goalpost is going to be moved and somebody else is going to be allowed to stay, then the whole pack of cards tumbles down, and the resentment and betrayal that she feels that Father has brought on her is unbearable. And it's pretty rough. But here's the wonderful thing about this film, Kay, is that everybody who watches this film now in 2025 and beyond, for the time being, can leave the cinema, and I do hope they see it on a big screen, because, you know, like all the films that I'm ever involved in, it's made for a big screen. It's not actually made for the end of your bed on your laptop or on the back of your wrist. Can leave the cinema and go out under the sky, and there are trees there, and there are birds there, and there are new faces that you don't know that you can encounter. And all of those luxurious elements of life, the life that we know on Earth, are not available to this family, this incredibly rich family under the Earth. They don't have any of those things. And I think, for the time being, as long as we have access to all of those things, it is an interesting opportunity, this film. It gives us an interesting opportunity to take pause, to understand how we value those things and what we can do to try and keep them going.
Now, at the Berlin Film Festival earlier this year, you received a Lifetime Achievement Award. Did you take time then to look back at your work, your early work with Derek Jarman and Sally Potter, and that work that started you on this amazing career?
You know, a retrospective is such a strange and very challenging thing. I've been honoured by retrospectives in the past. This one was particularly powerful for me because Berlin is where I started my life's work. I went with my first film to the Berlin Film Festival with Derek Jarman, Caravaggio, in 1985, which is... we made that film in 1985. That is 40 years ago. It's hard for me to say those words. I can't quite believe it. It feels about five. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. I have been reflecting a lot. I mean, maybe everybody reflects when they've been working for 40 years. Maybe that just comes with the territory. It's sort of the page turns and you have this opportunity to look back. And I'm very aware how grateful I am. I have a wonderful road to look back on. I'm incredibly grateful for my start, because where I've ended right now is absolutely tied to my start. I'm still talking with and working with the people that I worked with then, if they're still alive, and they aren't all, but, you know, there's a feeling of real complicity and continuation and ongoingness in my life, which I'm so grateful for. But it's a funny thing, that kind of honour, because for a start, you feel like saying, I'm not done yet. I mean, are you saying you want me to leave? Is it a very gentle way of saying, here's your hat?
Tilda, there was one thing, you know, the film, the end part filmed in Ireland. And I heard something where you mentioned Maureen O'Hara, the great Irish actress. Oh. And you have a particular admiration of her.
I met her. I was so grateful to meet her. Not long before she left us, she was honoured by the American Academy. And I happened to be present when she was. And I met her, and she was exactly as I'd hoped she would be. She had that absolute twinkle in her eye, and was absolutely present and incredibly beautiful, as I would always hope. And yeah, I love her. I love Maureen O'Hara.
Well, Tilda Swinton, thank you so much for talking to us on Arena.
Thank you, Kay. And I will say that it was such a pleasure to be in Ireland and shoot part of the end there. And I am longing to come back. It's my daughter's sweetheart is from Sligo. And so I feel it's a family seat right now. So
well, it's just a jump across the sea from Scotland.
It won't be long. I'll be there.
Tilda Swinton, and The End is in selected cinemas. Our reviewers will give their views later in the show. RTE has announced the call for entries for the 2025 RTE Short Story Competition, one of Ireland's most prestigious literary prizes. This competition, held in honour of the esteemed writer and broadcaster Francis McManus, is open to writers over the age of 18 living in Ireland, as well as Irish writers worldwide. The competition is free to enter and celebrates the best new Irish fiction written for radio. The winning author will receive a cheque for €5,000, while the second and third placed winners will be awarded €4,000 and €3,000, respectively. Participants have until May the 23rd to submit their short stories written in English or Irish, and the stories should fall between a word count of 1,800 to 2,000 words. This year's panel of judges includes writer Neil Hegarty, Tristan Rosenstock and Jan Carson, and I'm delighted to be joined by Neil and Tristan here in studio and Jan on the line. But before we speak to them, let's listen to last year's finalist. The final was broadcast on a special arena at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. The winner was Matty Brennan, who received a cheque for €5,000 for his short story Dead Bait. Let's listen to a short extract from it, now read by Aaron Monaghan.
I see a gleam of light up ahead, near the turn for the main road. My stomach lurches till I realise it isn't neon blue. It's a vertical stream of pale light, as if someone is shining a powerful torch up to the sky. I slow down, hunch forward, and squint. As I near it, I can make out the shape of a small yellow car, a Fiesta. But it's all wrong. It's on its side, a mess in the ditch. One headlight is shining upwards, the other is smashed in. I lower the window. There's no sound from its engine. I'm at crawling pace now, inching past the wreckage, when I hear a faint cry. Unconsciously, I brake hard, shift into neutral and pull up the handbrake. A hoarse, frail voice is calling out. Help.
Well, that was an extract there, read by Aaron Monaghan of Dead Bait, which was the winning entry, written by Matty Brennan. Neil, Tristan and Jan, you're all very welcome. And we wish you luck with getting all those stories that are going to come in down to the 10 on the shortlist. Neil, you're the judge with the link to last year. So you would have been one of the judges that chose Matty. Was he a clear winner last year?
It was a very tight bunch at the end. There was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and backwards and forwards. But at the end, we were all in full agreement that this was the best one. This was the one that deserved to win. It was so atmospheric. It was so taut. And it was about a moral dilemma, a moral choice that had to be made. which way would this guy go? And everything was left up in the air until the very last minute. It was a tour de force. It was a brilliant story, and we were very, very glad to award it the winner.
Do you decide the winner based on the page, or do you also listen to the audio before you decide?
We have access to the audio towards the end of the process, but really we decide on the written text. There's a lot of conversations, there's a lot of meetings, it's all very open. And we have to go in really with sort of happy to have our own champions, to bat for the ones that we really like. And then, of course, equally important, we have to be prepared to listen and to listen and to listen.
That's good he's saying that, isn't it, Tristan? It's great to listen. Tristan, you work in radio and you're also a writer. How important is writing for radio or writing for the ear rather than just reading the story?
Yeah, it's definitely to be taken on board, because, you know, the listener will typically only hear this once. And you know, when you're writing on the page, you can have a lot of punctuation to break it up. That's a bit harder for, we heard Aaron Monaghan read earlier on, and, you know, we typically there are fantastic actors reading these works, but very, very long, clunky sentences will challenge anyone, I think. So it's definitely important to bear in mind that the stories that you write will have to land well on the ear. And, you know, when you listen to Sunday with Selny every week, you know, you get that kind of cadence, you get that rhythm of what typically works duration-wise on radio. So, you know, we're very lucky now that we can listen to various short stories on different platforms, like The New Yorker are great, you know, and they have some of our own writers featured quite frequently. So I think listening to short stories would definitely be good practice when you're out walking, and just kind of familiar yourself with the kind of rhythms and cadences that typically work well in audio.
Jan, you have written for radio for one whole book of yours was based on a series you wrote for BBC Four.
Yes, and I totally agree there with everything Tristan said, but I'd also maybe throw into the mix, if anyone's listening and thinking about entering, just to remember that radio is a particularly intimate kind of experience for the listener reader, and voice is everything when it comes to writing a story for the reader. And my producer once told me, what you're trying to go for is a kind of, come here, listen in. I'm going to tell you something that maybe no one else is going to hear. And you really want something that, do you know that thing when you're listening to a story on the radio and you get to the end of your journey in the car and you just stay on in the drive for another few minutes because it's so good, you can't bear to get out of the car and leave it without the end.
What would you say is the particular art to writing a short story, Jan?
Oh gosh, I wish you could tell me and then maybe I could get a bit better at it. I think there are so many rules that people throw about, and to be honest, every single short story is its own peculiar wee world. And, you know, you really, I keep coming back to that idea of a voice, something that feels like you're beckoning the reader to really invest in the story you're telling. Also, you know, Neil talked there a little bit about the cadence and the language and the rhythm. That's particularly important when you're writing for the radio. And I think finally for me, really good, strong characters. Somebody that you want to spend time with, either because they're so appealing or they're so heinous that you just need to keep listening.
Would you agree with that, the importance of character and how you develop character?
Yes, absolutely. And I would also say, be comfortable with all the stuff that you don't have space to put in. It's a short story. You only have a very small amount of space. Mm. So don't see that as a challenge. See it as a sort of as a lovely luxury. And you can depend upon your reader to do the imaginative heavy lifting. It's a great feeling of kind of respect when as a reader, you see that somebody is kind of handing it over to you, saying you can do the rest yourself.
Tristan, is 2,000 words, up to 2,000 words, is that a very short story?
It is, yeah. And I know some writers might be a bit concerned. They might be looking at something they've written that's well above 3,000 words and think, how will I cut this back? Maybe you won't. Maybe it's time to think about a new story. You do have a few months. But at the same time, like, we're seeing a lot of flash fiction, I think, in the last few years. Certainly in the Irish language, flash fiction or splankiction is really thriving at the moment. And, you know, a book that won an award at the Unpost Book Awards last year, Ganza Hamora, each story in the collection was under 1,000 words, and yet they still packed a punch. There was a twist at the end. There was, you know, there were very strong characters who stayed with me long afterwards. So while 2,000 words is probably considered on the short side, I think there's still plenty of space there to develop a story. And just to go back to the idea of character, you know, a plot twist will stay with me for a few days, a few weeks maybe, but it's the characters that really stay with you for a long time. So really, for me, character is central here. And you don't need to wrap up everything at the end of your story. You know, leave us guessing, leave us imagining what might have happened to that character. That's one way of ensuring that they'll stay with us for a long time.
Jan, you had quite a list of tips to give people who were setting about writing.
Yeah, I did. I got asked to put a few thoughts together. I think they're up on the RTE website if anyone wants to have a longer read at it. But yeah, I think just to echo what everyone has said already, and I maybe also add just this idea of trust in yourself. Every short story writer comes at storytelling from a different angle. And I think the best piece of advice anybody ever gave me in writing as a whole was that you are uniquely placed to tell your story. You know, no one else can tell the story that you can tell. And just to give people confidence who are maybe listening and haven't had a go at writing before, This could be a really good opportunity to try something. And, you know, you have a story to tell.
Now, you talk about contrived storylines and showy gimmicks. What's a showy gimmick, Jan?
I don't want to feel cheated by a short story. I was asked earlier today about some of my favourite short stories. One is a story by the Welsh writer Caris Davis called The Quiet. And at the end of it, there is quite a twist, but it's a shock, but not a surprise. If you go back through the story, you can see where she's done the foreshadowing. And so this big reveal comes as it's shocking, but it doesn't feel like a gimmick that we've, you know, had the wool pulled over our eyes the whole way through the story. And I prefer that to something coming out of nowhere that feels just very contrived and gimmicky.
We did ask you all to think of some short stories, really by way of illumination for people, so that they'd see this is a good way to go. And you picked Paul McPhee, Neil.
I did. And this is a brand new short story collection, I Hear You. And what struck me at the time last week as I was reading it is that each of these stories was actually written for radio. And even more interestingly, each story is 2,000 words long, i.e. a 14-minute radio slot. So it's an interesting one to pick up if you're looking for ways in which other people, somebody else has already done it. It works really, really well. And as Tristan said, it really shows that 2,000 words, it sounds not very long. In fact, it's absolutely ample. You can do whatever you want in 2,000 words.
What can you recall from them that might give people a hint as to, you know, a good way to approach a short story from the Paul McPhee stories, Neil?
There was a fantastic story in it called The Singer, which is a reworking of the film Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which, you know, has everything in it already. It has tension, it has a family struggle, it has jealousy, it has satisfaction when things go right for one person, go really badly wrong for somebody else. It has the elements of a soap opera, but it's extremely tight and taut and very, very disciplined. And as Paul in his story writes it, it's all about voice. As Tristan and Jan have said, it's all about getting the voice right, pulling you in so you feel like you're sitting down and being told something very, very intimate.
I think, Tristan, you picked one of Colin Barrett's, which the collection Young Skins was seen as such a wonderful, exciting collection of short stories. What is it about the way he writes that you think is a good, maybe, we're not saying to copy these stories, obviously, but it's just to say how you might approach a short story.
Yeah, and I must get my hands on Paul McPhee's collection as well. It sounds like nearly a manual of how to write a short story for the Francis McManus competition. but Colin Barrett, mean, that debut was just absolutely stunning. I remember when I read it, talking to an uncle of mine who's a total bibliophile, and we both agreed it was the most impressive debut that we could recall. Barrett is just a master, I think. You know, and this the story I chose was Stand Your Skin, and we were talking earlier on about characters, and the character in this story, Bat, we know him as, he stayed with me ever since, and it's maybe 5 or 6 years since I read this collection. Anytime I hear a story in the news or read a story in the paper about these unprovoked attacks that happen, this Bat character comes back into my head, because we just see how his whole life was transformed and destroyed, really, by being unfortunate enough to walk into a kebab shop on a night he shouldn't have gone out, really, you know. And he spends the rest of his life in hiding and really, I suppose, self-medicating with alcohol, and just completely tormented by this horrific act that happened, and really could have happened to anybody at all. It's a story that has stayed with me, because I keep imagining what kind of life Bat is living in rural Mayo now. Is he still hiding out? Has he developed any self-esteem at all?
And I'd be right in saying that Colin Barrett has a very distinctive voice, hasn't he?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, we wanted to see, could he do it in novel form? And sure enough, he could. I just think he's a stunning writer. He barely puts a word wrong. His sentences are just absolutely complete and perfect. And he's just a joy to read, I think.
Turning people's expectations on their heads is a huge thing as well, Jan. I think you've seen that in the Flannery O'Connor, a story you picked. It's called Good Country People.
Yeah, it's maybe a story people are familiar with. I'm a massive Flannery O'Connor fan. It's the story about the girl who's got a wooden leg. Her name is Holga, and she gets seduced by a travelling Bible salesman who takes her up into the hayloft and has his wicked way with her, and runs off with her leg, so she can't get back down again. What I love about this story is it's very atypical of O'Connor, in that she goes straight to kind of the dark heart of humanity, and you see just how awful these people are, but also their kind of vulnerability. And we know we've talked a lot about character today, and you could go a long way before you'll get better character profiles than O'Connor's short stories. I'd very much recommend the collection that story's from, which is called A Good Man Is Hard to Find. Sadly, it will not tell you how to find a good man, but it might tell you how to write a good short story.
Yeah, and obviously the prosthetic leg stealer was not a good man.
No, although she's not a particularly good woman either. So it's a lot of dodgy characters in Flannery O'Connor.
And Neil, you picked a fellow Northern writer, Windy Erskine, who has been on the show many times and has had a number of collections of short stories. I think she's just working on a novel now.
She's a fantastic short story writer, and she has a great line that I've heard her say now several times. She focuses in her stories on quote-unquote ordinary lives. And when people say, why do you focus on ordinary lives? She says, well, where are all these extraordinary people? Where do they all live? Her point being, of course, that every single life is extraordinary. And all we need to do to have access to these extraordinary lives is to go to the supermarket, is to get on a bus, is to eavesdrop on somebody else's conversation, and everything is there. It's free. If you're looking for something to write about, step outside of your front door, I think is what Wendy is saying, and I think it's what everybody would say if they're interested in the short story
form.
Yeah,
I think you picked one called Mathematics. I think I remember that from Dance Move, about Roberta. I think she's a cleaner in an apartment block, is that
exactly
right?
Yeah, she really is a quote-unquote ordinary person. She cleans houses, and Wendy doesn't hold back from the descriptions of all this cleaning that she has to do. But then the story takes this unexpected turn, and suddenly you're hooked and you want to know more. So this is an ordinary person, and it turns out that she's not ordinary at all, and her life isn't ordinary, and the point is, of course, it never has been.
Right, and would you, it's set up as thinking, oh, what could be more ordinary than following this woman cleaning a building around, exactly. And suddenly you get into her interior life,
suddenly you're
which
hooked.
Leads to an action as well.
Yes, exactly.
Your second one, Tristan, is The Pub With No Beer by Kevin Barry. And Kevin is such a musical writer. He's a great writer for the year, isn't he?
He is, and that's why people flock to see him at festivals throughout the country. People are just dying to see Kevin Barry perform, and it is a performance. You know, when Kevin Barry reads from his work, you know, you'll hear a pin drop in the room. Now, he's kind of cheating, or he makes life very easy for himself, because the prose he writes is so inherently musical. It's just beautiful, and you nearly want to read it out loud yourself at home. Now, this one was actually featured on the New Yorker website back in 2022. And Jan mentioned earlier on that a great short story, you know, creates its own unique world, and a closed pub, a pub that has been shut down, is its own unique world. And we were told in this one that it's a thoughtful pub, that it's that the publican is a lifelong performer. And we just go through the various scenarios that happened in this pub that no longer serves. But you get the sense of the whole community and the life of a small town in this one pub. You know, this was where there's solicitors and respectable people used to go for a drink. This is where, you know, there was never any trouble in this particular pub. So we get a sense of the type of clientele that frequented the place.
You can have lots of characters in a short story, can you?
You can have lots of characters in it, yeah. But the one thing I would say is if this short story will be read out loud, you can have a lot of characters, but just don't put too much dialogue in their mouth, because that's going to be very, very hard for even an actor as wonderful as Aaron Monaghan, who we heard earlier on. The more characters that an actor will have to deal with, the more complicated it's going to make things for them, I think.
So any words of wisdom just before we go, Jan, to get people with the word processor out?
Yeah, I'll maybe follow on what Tristan just said. If this is your first go at writing for radio, I'd recommend trying the first person voice. It's just often a lot easier and simpler to create that intimacy if you're in the first person.
Well, Jan, Neil and Tristan, thank you so much. Neil Hegarty, Tristan Rosenstock and Dan Carson are the judges, and so you might get reading their works to see what they like. The RT Short Story Competition is accepting entries now until the closing date on Friday, May the 23rd. For more information and all those details about length and how much money you might win, you can just get on to rt.ie/writing. And finally tonight, we bring you our film reviews. Holland is the latest release from Prime Video and boasts an impressive cast, including Gael Garcia Bernal, Nicole Kidman and Matthew McFadden, who play a couple in deeply conservative America. But is it all as it seems? One presumes not. An Taithe is an Irish language horror film set in a ghostly big house where a father and daughter contend with lots of spooky things. Donald Clark and Sarah Bellissimo join me now. But let's kick off with the end. You heard Tilda Swinton talking to me earlier. Donald, set the scene for us here. It's the end of the world.
Your introduction is wonderfully turned. It's the end of the world.
Yes.
It is.
It's all over.
We don't really see the end of the world in the film. We are in Tilda explained it. I listened to the interview very, very well. It's that we're in, she described it, a luxury dungeon, which puts it quite nicely. It's more accurately a luxury bunker. Joshua Oppenheimer, who is the great documentarian, a very witty and intelligent guy, got the idea for this when he was researching a documentary intended to make about the real people about real billionaires who actually construct these lairs for themselves beneath the earth, so they can live happily after the apocalypse comes in, I would have thought, you know, luxury misery, a luxurious form of misery. But he never got to make that. So when he was doing that research, he thought, what could I do with this? And come up with the notion of all things, a musical about a family living in that sort of environment. And the research is rigorous, that you have they have fish farms, and the fish produce fertilizer, which allows them to grow plants. Elsewhere, they've got a gym. They have all these luxurious things that you expect a family like that to have preserved after the apocalypse. They have this enormous collection of art down there. And as often happens in such stories, everything progresses along fine until a stranger arrives, which is always a good catalyst for the comfortable complacency to fall apart. This was an interesting kind of journey critically, in that it premiered at the Telluride Film Festival last autumn, and nobody got it, or rather very few people got it. And the kind of the word came out of it was like, oh God, what the hell is this? It, 2.5 hours long, almost all sung, a kind of miserable operetta that moves at a very stately pace, should be polite. And interesting what in the reviews coming up now as it's coming around to release, and people are kind of like, they've got it after having stewed it, having stewed in their brains for 6 months. And I got it too. I mean, I would say that it does not rattle along, it's not too short, but if you allow it to flow over you, it will get into your bones. And I think not least because there's a very powerful metaphor here. The story is the story itself sits there, as I say, where they're kind of placidly for the first hour and so forth. But the more general metaphor, I think, is effective. And this is about the complacency and the denial of these characters, but also our own complacency and denial, in that we all live in our version, well, in the West, we live in our version of the same luxury bunker, and we pretend that this chaos is not happening around us, and we pretend that the end of the world is not coming, and somehow convince ourselves that we are living in a comfort that we're not living in a comfort that's going to end sometime soon.
Now, as you said, it's a musical, so let's get a sense of how the music is used in the film. Here, Tilda Swinton, as mother, is singing about her parents. And here in the film, she is beginning to think of all the sacrifices she has made to be in this bunker with her husband. And I think she's not so happy about it.
Dear Mama, autumn's gone. Winter's here. Our whole world smells of cinnamon and oranges, and each season more perfect than the last. I'm sending love, dear Mom and Dad. I miss you both, but you never would be happy here. Each day feels exactly like the last. But I think of you always. Remember on car trips we'd sing all the road signs like Oprah, Last Exit in Kansas, or how we'd imagine the lives of the strangers in traffic jams. Mom can't tell jokes.
That's Tilda Swinton there singing one of the many songs which were sung live in the film at the end. So what Donald was saying there about it asks questions of how people delude themselves, and this family are so self-delusional. The son, who was born in the bunker, so he's an innocent, he is writing a biography of the father, and we have heard through other means that the father has been quite implicit in his industry of creating this wildfire that has, you know, got rid of the world.
Yeah, no, they do, but he doesn't feel that he did that, and he's passing that on to his son. They do live in a world of self-delusion. I have to say, I'm not like Donald. I after listening to Donald speak, I actually want to go back and watch the movie that he watched, because I didn't have the same reaction. It was so long. I love a good musical, but if you think you're going to come out of this singing songs like you did from Wicked, there's none of that happening in this. There's no toe tapping. All of that sort of washed over me, because it took forever to get to where it wanted to go. And I usually have a little bit of patience with a film, but I lost my patience. And so by the time that the message was being actually told, I missed it all, because I think I had zoned out 2.5 hours. The performances are amazing. And like, just listening back to Tilda there, heartbreaking. But I have to say, like, a lot of people will talk about Michael Shannon and George MacKay and Tilda, but Ireland's own Brona Gallagher, she is the one that actually, if I did shed an emotion, it was a tear when I was watching her performance.
Yes, she is the friend of the mother,
yeah.
But she has suffered her own tragedy. And then they kind of turn on her.
Oh, and it's horrible. You see, in that, you see how evil they are. And that was chilling. But I have to say, she was, for me, she was a standout in this film. This isn't a film that I would probably go see, but I'd see what Donald was talking about.
Yes. Do you think, Donald, that there was just too much of a setup before it got to how uncomfortable they were with each other? Even when the girl arrives, there's a lot of setup about how she gets on with the son.
Mm.
I just thought maybe that, you know, if they just had got to the point of challenge, she challenging the fairy tale they're living in.
Well, Oppenheimer is a famously adventurous filmmaker. I mean, the film which made him famous was The Act of Killing, which was a film about the Indonesian mass catastrophes in the mid-1960s, where he got the torturers to, now old men, to act out the appalling things that they did to these unfortunate people.
Using kind of film genres.
Years ago. You feel you're dealing with a brave man, and this film in that sense is less brave than The Act of Killing because the stakes aren't quite as high. But I get this sense of a sensibility to think, you know, I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to go at my own pace. And if you could run along with me, then that's great. And if you don't, you don't. And I can perfectly understand why a large number of people have not run along with it. And I will not pretend that I did not, that it had its longueurs. But nonetheless, by the time I left the cinema, I definitely had been won over by it. And I would say as well, I think that Tilda was interesting in the interview that you did with her, and I agree with her that though what Serena says is true, that towards the end they kind of reveal their kind of, like, you know, ghastly bourgeois colours, or more, actually not bourgeois, they're more, they're richer than the average bourgeois, but I think the actors were very strong actors, actually do allow a little bit of sympathy for these people. They're not the obvious brash, parodic rich people that you get in satires of the American rich.
Yes.
They actually are in their own way kind of ordinary and humane.
Yes, yes, yeah. I think Michael Shannon does a great job on that in being charming.
It's very well cast. Yeah. I mean, these are all good actors. And unsurprisingly, because The Act of Killing was such an admired film 10, 12 years ago, that you can pretty get these people into your film just by being Joshua Oppenheimer.
A stars out of five from you.
2.5 out of 5.
2.5. And from you, Donald?
4, I would say.
4, well, yes. You're saying it's going to be a cult classic. Is that what you were saying?
I kind of think that after it premiering to disappointing reviews, I think it's a kind of film that's going to linger around. I see that my colleague Peter Bradshaw in The Guardian gave it a full 5 stars. So people are coming around to it. I think future cult classic.
Now, I think you sat out Taifsha, but Donald, you have seen Taifsha.
Mm-hmm.
This is an Irish language horror film, and it's set in a big house.
Yes, I like this. I thought very good use of a very limited budget. There is, however, no escaping a certain parallel. This is a film about two people, a man and a woman, who go away, who are appointed as caretakers of a huge pile during the winter months, and the man goes steadily more alcoholically insane as the snow builds up and abuses the female character. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, it's The Shining, obviously. And to be fair to the director, John Farrelly, there is a scene towards the end which suggests to me that he knows that it's very close to The Shining. We get an echo of one of the scenes. Obviously, this is no spoiler because so much happens at the end of The Shining. We get an echo of one of the things that happens towards the end of The Shining. But that noted, it actually makes its own, it actually has its own voice beyond that, and manages a very effective accumulation of unease over an economic 90 minutes. I think that one thing I was slightly puzzled by is that if you are Irish and aware of the time period, it's set mid to late 19th century, you're aware that in the post-famine years, and you think there's probably something going on with the family, and I've read some interviews with him where he confirms that. But actually, if you didn't know Irish history, if you're approaching it from abroad, I don't think you'd really get that. There are some interesting images. You see a hill with an array of crosses across it, which surely points you in that direction. So I think there is actually, you know, a serious historical historical references going on through this. I thought pretty effective and recommended.
Does it work in the end?
I think it does work at the end, even even if the end is ambiguous. I mean, it is not one of those horror films which there are many you walk away not entirely sure what you've seen. But I thought it was a very interesting piece of work and brilliant use of, as I say, a clearly limited budget.
All right, stars out of five for Tyve Donald.
Three and a half.
Now, Holland. You've both seen Holland. It stars Nicole Kidman, Succession's Matthew McFadden. They're a married couple in deeply conservative community. Deeply conservative, Serena. They live in Holland in Massachusetts, is it?
It's somewhere in the United States.
It's Michigan, I think.
Is it Michigan?
Oh, right. Okay. And they wear clogs and grow tulips.
They pretend they live in Holland themselves and they have these festivals. And it's set in either the late 90s, early 2000s, because they've got, you know, that Nokia
phone.
Isn't it
funny how I have this theory that, like, you know, time stopped moving at some point in the late 1990s? Because it could be now until you see the old Nokia phones.
That's the only thing that gave it away. Mm-hmm. This is getting not great reviews, and I have to say myself, not great either. This 39% on Rotten Tomatoes. Again, it's another story. It's only an hour and 50 minutes, but it is so slow to build that by the time the twist, and there is a twist, by the time the twist kicks in, and it's a gruesome twist, you're still like, I don't care.
So they're a perfect couple, is that fair to say?
On the surface, it's almost like Wisteria Lane, you know, Stepford Wife type thing, perfect couple. She one day assumes that her husband is having an affair, so she approaches the teacher in her school, who's played by Gael Garcia Bernal, and says, can you help me track down whether or not he's having this affair? So they go, it's almost like this spy thriller. They don't expect to find out what they find out. And then it just all of a sudden turns and goes a different way. And it didn't work. I mean, it's great to see. Actually, this script had been shopped around for 10 years. Why?
Things that it was on this famous blacklist, which is this list they compile of the best unproduced screenplays. And so often when those films come to fruition and actually get made, they're not very good. And this is a classic example,
Donald, haven't we seen Nicole Kidman in films like this before? Like The Stepford Wives.
We have.
Bewitched and Lucy.
We have. And that kind of worried me a bit because Nicole Kidman, who I think has done excellent work recently, and we should point out that one of the things that she's done, which is really commendable, is she works with female filmmakers, again in this case, to a much greater level than most of her contemporaries.
19 in the last 8 years.
It's kudos impressive to her for that. But I mean, but I think she's done consistently good work. She was great in Baby Girl recently and a whole bunch of quality television. This does remind me of that rather slack period she went through in the early noughties when, as you say, Kay, films like The Stepford Wives and so forth were real duds and she wasn't good in them. And I'm sorry to say, I would love to say, Nicole Kidman's great, but nothing else works. She's not good in this. I mean,
so
she
didn't learn by not people, doesn't
she? She's doing this strange, kind of like cutesy, childish voice, which I don't know where that comes from, and that doesn't work. And it's sort of kind of a screwball platinum blonde thing, but that doesn't really work either. And I'm also sick to death of this thing that, you know, writers in West Hollywood have of parodies of suburban America based on a version of America from the 1950s. Like, you know,
really
don't go
kitschy
there. If you hate it so much, don't go there. Stay in West Hollywood.
Let's hear a clip. It's the clip you talked about. It's Nicole Kidman as Nancy shares her suspicions about her husband with her friend Dave, played by Gael Garcia Bernal.
He's never been to Madison, not that he ever told me. I mean, he told me that the conference was in Fort Wayne that day.
Okay.
Plus, if he paid for the ticket, how did he pay for it? Because I checked the bank accounts and the credit cards.
Check out the tulip fields. Every year we get
nothing. I found Polaroid film. We don't even own a Polaroid camera. So what does that tell you?
I don't know. Probably for his trains.
No! So he can take kinky sex photos with his lover and no one will see them. That's why.
That's a clip there from Holland, and Serena Bellissimo and Donald Clark have been reviewing our films tonight. I think we'll go to stars. Star out of five for you, Donald.
I'm going to generous two.
Oh, God.
I'm with Donald, and I'm just doing that for the cast, and the director tried with
kind
a really
of
bad script.
Operation, but yeah. It's basically
yeah, so two from you
two,
as
stay
well.
Away.
Okay, two out of five from both Serena Bellissimo and Donald Clark. Then on Paisha goes on general release tomorrow. The End will be in selected cinemas. Holland, 2 out of 5, will be available in Prime Video from tomorrow. That's it for tonight's show. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. James Feeney was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next.